What's up, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast. Austin, you're going to have to do it.
Oh, Show Me the Meaning!
What's up, guys? My name is Jared. We got the Show Me the Meaning crew here today. We got Austin.
Yo.
And I think this is the first time him being on this podcast, but if you listen to our South Park podcast, you may remember him. We have Michael Lux with us. What's up, Lux?
Yo, what up, dudes?
Doing well, man. So today we're talking about Inglourious Basterds, the 2009 film written and directed by Quentin Tarantino, starring Brad Pitt, Christoph Waltz, and Melanie Laurent. As always, let's go around and get some first impressions. What was it like the first time you watched this movie? What is it like rewatching it? Let's start with Austin. Austin, what do you think about this movie?
Yeah, so the first time I saw this movie, it had a really profound impact on me, actually, because it was right when, for people who have listened to this regularly, know that I was kind of training to be a pastor and a theologian, and so it was right during my critical turn out of that, when I had just started reading postmodern literature, and we had this English professor at our university that was having us read like psychoanalytic criticism. So we were reading like Zizek and then postmodern stuff like Umberto Eco. And so I'm going into this film as the first time that I had seen a Tarantino film with this type of lens. And then for other people who know, I watched Tarantino films because I didn't convert to Christianity until a little bit later, even though I was kind of raised in the church, but you know, rebellious teen shit. So I'd seen Tarantino films, but for me, they were just kind of like simple exploitation films that were like, oh, cool. You know, there's some flashy shit going on. But this was the first one that thematically resonated with me. And I remember I came out of the movie jazzed, especially at the bit when Aldo at the end says, I think this might be my masterpiece. Because I was like, oh, I see what Tarantino's saying. Like, this film is his masterpiece. And I remember being jacked up and sitting around with a bunch of my buddies afterwards. And we just couldn't stop talking about this film. And so I've seen it a handful of times since then. But interestingly enough, I kind of had more of a sort of negative critical experience of it watching it last night. Mm. And I have been thinking about these sorts of things a lot over the past year in particular, but about maybe some of the consequences of exploitation and some of the consequences of simple style without any sort of grounded ethical compass or anything like that, which I think really defines Tarantino. Not that there is no ethical compass, but that even within style, there is a substance. And I'm curious to kind of like work through what is actually going on in these films and why I think that there may be some elements that would be, for everybody, a bit problematic. So I'm interested to talk about it.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because largely what's motivating this podcast is because we did our awesome podcast on Django Unchained, and that was a really great conversation, and that was able to inform us to make a video about it. And this has always been a movie that's kind of evaded me in terms of if I could figure out if there was anything really interesting going on. And so I'm glad that I'm looking to do the same thing, see if we can figure out if anything cool is going on in this movie. But it's not my turn yet. Lux, what do you think about this movie?
Okay, so for some context, Alec, who I know has been on the show before, has referred to me as Wisecrack's resident Antifa super soldier. And this movie speaks to that part of me in an extremely intense way. Not only am I like a Jewish leftist in real life, I'm literally descended from Nazi hunters. My mom's dad was one. Also, my mom's aunt and uncle were leaders of the Bialystok concentration camp uprising, where they died, but everyone there did. And so this movie like is extremely close to my heart in that respect, because it's like a real tap into like the lost annals of the Luxembourg clan, I guess Etkind clan. So when I first saw it as a kid, knowing all this stuff, I fucking immediately fell in love with it, like politics aside, just sort of like the same catharsis I get from like playing Wolfenstein on easy and just like murdering Nazis like in a video game. It's the same sort of like ethnic catharsis sort of thing, especially growing up with a rabbi for a dad and like hearing about Holocaust stuff all the time. It made it really cathartic. And then watching it now was really crazy, because a lot of that like energy has become like organizing stuff and politics stuff. And then watching this movie in a world where like Nazis are back, like Nazi Part Two is happening and all that other stuff, you know, the whole world that we live in and its attendant bullshit. Watching this movie in that context is like really crazy and opened up actually, I think, a lot of really interesting things that, knowing Tarantino's other work, I don't think could have possibly been intentional at the time, but are like kind of really profound in retrospect, which I'm excited to talk about. I think there's a lot of really interesting stuff in here. But yeah, this movie like definitely speaks to my inner BJ Blazkowicz in a really intense way, which is a large component of my personality generally.
All right. Interesting. I don't love this movie. I don't dislike it. I like it, but just on a very surface level, I'm in general not a fan of really, really, really long Quentin Tarantino scenes. I mean, there's no doubt they're impressive. Sometimes during the whole bar in the basement scene, that scene is what? Seemingly, it feels like it's 30 minutes long, but
it's not far off.
It's very tense, and it's cool that he can keep something engaging for that long, but it's not necessary, damn it. Mm. And I don't know. I really, really don't like this movie as much as I like Django. And since we recently made the video on Django and talked about Django on the podcast, I was really hoping to revisit this film and get like a big, oh, duh moment. Mm. But nothing ever really came. I don't know. What do you guys think about Brad Pitt in this movie? Because I am kind of not impressed.
You know what? I feel like, and I thought this last night, and then I had to look through his filmography to see if maybe I was just reinterpreting history according to my own projections. But I think there's some truth to this. This film signals like some sort of shift in at least one timeline that is Brad Pitt's films. Because I know after this he did like, what is it, Killing Me Softly or Killing Them Softly, whatever, which is a rad fucking movie.
I didn't see it, but he is in that.
And that's a rad movie, and that's a couple years later. But this film, he like has done this now a few times where it's like this and then Fury. And then even in the new film trailer that just got released for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, he has that like Southern accent thing. And it's almost like there's this character that Brad Pitt created, and it's Aldo that is now popping up in all of these other subsequent films. And I don't love it. Like, it's a little, and I love Brad Pitt. I think Brad Pitt is underrated for just being the pretty boy, and people neglect his acting chops. I think he's actually a really good actor in the right context. But I don't know. There's just something kind of ham-fisted about this a little bit.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. I like Brad Pitt a lot, and I agree with you that there are a lot of roles that he's generally underappreciated for. But I think the Aldo performance kind of breaks.
My take on this is that, like, I think that, like, physically and timing-wise, it's actually a really extraordinarily good performance. I think the accent's very bad.
It is.
I think the accent's very bad, and it like cheapens a lot of what he's doing, because like his movements and his timing are really good. He even brings like a cool menace with the way he cocks his head sometimes, or his eyebrows. His like smirk is really on point for like a guy who's going to kill you later. But he has a terrible fucking accent.
Yeah, that makes everything seem silly. In the basement is really kind of sweet when he's talking to the young father, right? I mean, it is kind of, you genuinely, I believe him that he's not going to kill the guy, even though, you know, he probably will. And it's Bridget von Heimer's Mark actually kills the kid. But, you know, that's kind of a nice touching moment. So the performance isn't bad. But I think you're right, Lux. I think it's the accent.
It's just so fucking distracting.
Yeah.
The first scene when you see the bastards and he's doing his walk in front of them and he's trying to get them all jazzed, that's probably the worst scene for me, but maybe it's just an onboarding process, because towards the end of the movie when he's having his conversation with Landa and he's trying to negotiate for his surrender, I was into it. I bought it. But man, I just, even in the theater, I remember watching that scene, which works really well in the trailer because there's all this music and it's intercutting with all these scenes of revenge. But when it's just Brad Pitt talking to his army, it really doesn't work.
Well, it carries like, he does it with this like smug self-assurance of like, again, a guy who knows he's going to kill you later. And he does everything that way. And I think that when he's playing off someone, when he's interacting with Landa or interacting with Wilhelm, or even interacting with the other bastards a lot of the time, that plays a lot stronger than when he's just sort of monologuing.
When he's
monologuing, it's just sort of like, okay, bud, like, rein it in. Like, we get it.
Yeah.
Like, who are you trying to impress right now? Whereas, like, when he's talking to Landa, it's, like, very obvious who he's trying to impress.
I mean, with that said, though, I think the acting across the board otherwise is stellar.
Oh, Melanie Laurent in this movie is fucked up good.
Oh, she's so good. I mean, I fell in love with her after seeing this movie. Like,
yeah,
literally.
This is true story. My, like, serious major movie crush throughout high school.
Absolutely.
I was 17 when this movie came out, was Melanie Laurent.
Oh, see, for me,
I think
when I fell in love with Melanie Laurent, isn't there like a rom-com with her and Ewan McGregor, Beginners, isn't she in that?
I think so.
That was
when I fell in love with Melanie Laurent. It wasn't this movie. It was a little bit later. But
we've all fallen in love with her nihilistic, like, I don't give a fuck French attitude when she's sitting there reading that novel and smoking the cigarette with the hat pulled down. I was like, yep, that's it. And then I was like, okay, that, where is my Melanie Laurent?
Right. It's like, I mean, like, you can, I mean, this is going to come as no surprise, but like, oh, cool. Like a very pretty Jewish cinephile Nazi murderer. Boy, like, that's really custom fit to my OKCupid profile, huh?
Yeah. I want, even though Michael Fassbender, even though his accent is also kind of hammy, it's intentionally over the top Queen's English, right? But I think he's
especially when he's in a room, especially when he's in a room performing against Michael Myers,
right? Who's Mike doing Myers. A sort of Basil? What's it? Was that his name? Basil from Austin Powers?
From Austin Powers,
absolutely is.
He's doing Basil. Yeah. But I think the acting is across the board is fantastic. So for me, even though I don't love Brad Pitt, to kind of summarize the point from my experience anyway, I think overall it kind of washes out because the rest of the performances I think are just so stellar. So,
yeah. All right, let's go into a recap and let's see if we can figure out something smart about this movie. In Nazi-occupied France, 17-year-old Shoshana's family is killed right before her eyes by Hans Landa, known throughout the land as the Jew Hunter, under direct order from the Führer to snuff out all the Jews hiding in France. Shoshana narrowly escapes. Meanwhile, Lieutenant Aldo Rain puts together a unit of Jewish-American soldiers known as the Bastards to infiltrate behind enemy lines and massacre Nazis. Their brutality and effectiveness has spread throughout the German military. 4 years later, Shoshana, in disguise, is working at a cinema where she meets a film-loving German war hero named Friedrich Zoller. Despite Shoshana rebuffing his advances, Zoller insists that the premiere of the movie valorizing his war story happens at her cinema, where Landa will be head of security. So she plans to fill it with Nazis and burn it to the ground. Meanwhile, a British soldier named Archie is sent undercover to similarly blow up the premiere. He teams up with the Bastards to meet up with double agent German film star Bridget von Hammersmark in order to gain admittance to the premiere. Archie's cover is blown and all die but von Hammersmark in the gunfight, making Aldo and two other Bastards clumsily disguise themselves as Italians and accompany her to the premiere, which we learn Hitler will also be attending. Under the keen eye of Landa, von Hammersmark's cover is blown at the premiere and she is killed. Aldo is captured and Landa bargains his way to a luxurious life in America in exchange for allowing their plan to go forward and end the war. Shoshana and Zoller kill each other, but not before her plan is set into motion. The theater burns down and the Bastards kill Hitler, Goebbels, and all the other high-ranking Nazis. With the war all but over, Landa surrenders to Aldo on American territory, but Aldo etches a swastika into his forehead so that he can never take off the uniform. End of movie.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
All right, guys. So, you know, the first thing I want to talk about and what I think is probably the ripest territory for something smart to say is what's going on with the whole meta cinema thing, where just to set the stage for that, in an interview, Tarantino said that it's 35mm film that kills the Nazis. Mm. So what I'm talking about here is that throughout the movie, there is an emphasis on cinema. So Shoshana owns a theater. Bridget von Hammersmark is a film star spy. Shoshana makes a film. 35mm nitrate film is literally the fuel that explodes the Nazis. Michael Fassbender's character is a film critic that focuses on German cinema. G.W. Pabst, who is a German filmmaker, is mentioned a number of times. He's even on one of the playing cards in the bar scene. So what's going on here, guys? Is it that just as the theater built them up with all those propaganda films, so will it tear them down? Is it that cinema always has the last word? And that's what Tarantino is saying, is that, you know, I revise history, or I at least revise the general sentiment toward this event in history. Is it that real justice can only exist in cinema, where we can fantasize such a terrible end for Hitler that perhaps he actually deserved? What do you guys think?
I'm really glad you brought that up, because it didn't strike me that way until this viewing. And this is one of the things that I found maybe a bit problematic about Tarantino as a person. And listen, I don't want to judge him too harshly. So when I say this, there's a little bit of levity when I'm using the word problematic. People who listen to this know that I use it not in the way that the typical culture war tries to use it, right? I use it in its like philosophical lineage deriving from various certain figures to sort of problematize something and unpack something. And I think we can do that with Tarantino because the motherfucker thinks that cinema is the only thing that matters in this world. And that is fine, you know? And so I think he thinks that, yes, you're absolutely right, Jared, that cinema has the power to redeem, to create justice as the primary mode of storytelling that binds human communities today, more so than, you know, oral tradition and ceremonial dance. Those things don't bind advanced capitalist societies in their storytelling ventures. It's cinema that does. I think he does think that there's a similar potency in storytelling through this medium that maybe has always existed, that is now the most integral component of what it means to be human. Whether or not that's true is the issue, because he does seem to think that somehow this film, and maybe for Lux it doesn't, maybe for me it doesn't, and maybe I'm missing something because I don't have that lived experience, so I'm curious to see what Lux says, but that there will be a genuine, like, material effect that is cathartic that film can have and that this film in particular has, that I'm just not sure that we ought to take him that seriously. And then the last thing I'll say real quick is then I also think there's another layer to this as well. It's film that does this. And because Tarantino's an outspoken critic of digital, if you don't have film and you only have digital, you won't be able to start the fire to create this kind of cathartic release. So I think there's also a sense in which he's trying to argue for the purity of film per se as being the thing that can create this type of effect.
A couple of things. One, I totally agree on the question of like film versus digital. He's clearly emphasizing the value of like the physical medium. And he's also very much interested in this idea of like, because yeah, like you said, the catharsis in this movie, like as a Jewish dude who like of my background, like, yeah, it's mega real. But if the fact that it can be sort of non-real speaks to the fact that he got a couple of things sort of fundamentally wrong about how things work. One of which is that I think part of what he's trying to say is like, sure, this movie ending story isn't actually how Hitler and shit died, but it's how they stay dead, right? Like the stories we tell about like the Nazis are the bad guys, Indiana Jones, original Captain America, et cetera, is how like Nazis stay dead, like in the mythology, right? In the cultural mythology. This is what he's wrong about, though, because he did not anticipate like Twitter and memes and YouTube and all this shit, right? Like in his in his sort of meta telling of the story, it's that we make movies to provide this ethical compass to the world, and Inglourious Basterds is one that's like solidifies for all of us, hey, remember, Nazis are very bad. But didn't realize that there was kind of, I mean, and how could he have? This is what I mean by saying like there are things he clearly couldn't have anticipated making this movie. Like the rise of sort of social media and memes, the ability to sort of create an oral tradition that recontextualizes these things in a new different way, i.e. the resurgence of American Nazism and shit. Like he's really missed the role of technology there. And so that meta element of the movie for me is one of the things. So yeah, like I said before, like there are things with this movie that worked when I was a kid or teen that do not work for me now in the 2019 to 2007 like time span. But there are things that didn't necessarily work for me as a kid that do work for me now. That we can get to later, but this in particular is one where it's like, well, I see the point you're making, but like history says you're wrong, bud.
Lux, do you think it's just because he just doesn't have, he's like a bit of a digital Luddite, like he just doesn't understand it, so he can't realize that there's a world beyond his limited epistemological frame?
I think that's
well, to be
question.
Fair, this is 2009, ancient history at this point.
I think that,
I mean, right? Like,
I think
nobody
that the question
saw this
you're
coming.
Asking, Austin, is one that we might actually have a good answer to after a fucking Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Because that's going to be his first movie that comes out, like, in the midst of, like, this version of social media, in the midst of this version of politics and the problematization of social positions and et cetera, et cetera. And what he has to say about that and how it interacts with that, if at all, I think is going to be very revealing about his understanding of the world, the digital world as such, I guess.
Maybe that's why I have an anxiety about this film coming out, his new film coming out. Like, not like a, like anxiety where I stay in my bed all day and I cry, but like just in terms of my expectation for the film, there's an ambivalence there because I'm kind of like, I don't know if he gets the world now. Like, I don't know if he's, I think that, you know how he said he's going to make 10 films? I'm like, I think that's a good idea. He should write novels now. Because I just don't know that he is a voice for our time in a
God,
way that can
so
say anything interesting
hear,
or critical, you know?
No, yeah. I hear you. Because even in the Django podcast, we said he couldn't do this today.
Yeah, and when was that? 2012?
2012, yeah.
Yeah.
Late 2012.
No, there's no way he could pull off Django now. Even if he did everything exactly the same, I think that there's just things that wouldn't have worked. Plus, I don't think he would have done things exactly the same because things are different now. And, like, yeah, it's a weird thing where I have a real... I still, like, love Tarantino as, like, a stylish filmmaker. Like, those scenes that you were talking about, Jared, I think are, as you say, unnecessary but incredible achievements.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's nothing I like better than an unnecessary, incredible achievement. And so I love that shit. But there is, like, he does really seem to sort of be, like kind of like a 90s punk trying to tell people in 2019 how to, yes, like, think about stuff.
Exactly.
We haven't seen his 2019 movie yet.
What?
Well, I'm just saying the 2019 movie hasn't come out yet, so...
Right, so that's...
Right, okay.
Yeah. Which then sets him up for, like, some sort of nostalgic revival 30 years from now, when people are going to be like, oh, like, they're discovering vinyl now. They're going to be like, oh, you know, Tarantino really was this genius all along, and he's back to the real stuff. And somehow, like, postmodern bricolage will then be viewed as, like, getting us back to materiality, because who knows where the fuck we'll end up in 30, 40 years, right?
Yeah. I mean, I feel more positively, honestly. Like, I feel like a lot of this conversation about the next movie comes from the fact that I, like, think Hateful Eight is bad.
It's so bad.
And so it was like, well, you've really undone the magic.
It
was like, you're infallible. Oh, wait, no.
Yeah, like, I know.
You botched one.
That was
so now
a
we all
huge
are a little
bummer
more
for me.
Yeah. I think you're right.
God, yeah. I hate that movie.
So a couple other things about this Metacinema thing, just some details that I think were pretty cool. So Shoshana dresses like a film star in the final chapter in the night of the premiere. She becomes kind of the opposite of the Nazi myth of the Jews, and it's really cool to see her. You know, what it brought to mind Schindler's List. Now, I know in a lot of ways, aesthetically, this movie is the inversion of a very earnest film like Schindler's List or even Saving Private Ryan. But there is a similarity in that the undoing of the Nazis. Now, I haven't seen Schindler's List in a while, but isn't it that the guy that Ralph Fiennes plays falls in love with a Jewish girl, and that's kind of his undoing, whereas basically Frederick Zoller's, and which ends up being Hitler's undoing, is that he similarly falls in love with a Jewish woman who's, right? Isn't that how it goes?
Big confession, never seen Schindler's List. To quote my dad, I don't think you should make movies about the good Nazi.
Have you seen Schindler's List, Austin?
I haven't seen it since I was a kid, so I don't even remember.
Oh, Jesus. All right, well, move on to the next point, then.
Sorry to let you down there, bud.
No, all good, man. Yeah, that's pretty much all I got on that's all I got on Metacinema. You guys want anything to say anything else before I move on?
Well, real quick, because we mentioned it a few times, I just want to say those long scenes for me, I know, Jared, mm-hmm. they didn't quite work for you. Lux, you said you love them. I will agree with Lux on this in that because I come from the theater world more than anything, for me, those scenes, like... The opening scene, I feel like it doesn't have the same impact on repeated viewings because you know what this is leading to. But when you go in unaware to a cinema and you see the joy and the precision and the patience that Landa takes with his job in hunting these people hiding under the floorboards for their lives, I was so gripped. You know, and even now it still gets me, but not to the same level. I mean, because there was just something so transformative and new. I'd never really seen Christoph Waltz before. I was like, who is this fucking actor? First of all, he's absolutely stellar. And then just the little bits, like when he pulls out the pipe, you know, and it's just this comically oversized pipe, when he drinks the milk in a way that it's almost orgasmic. I mean, it's those details. Every scene of Landa's actually is like that. I feel like if you take all those scenes together, you would have a really interesting sort of stylistic analysis. Like even the bit when he has Shoshana, who is now Emmanuel Mimieux at the time, eat the pastry with the cream. And like that fucking scene is I think that scene might be even more tense because of the emotional stakes that the film has built to at that point. And you're like, what the fuck's going to happen? And you know that he knows, right? Like, he knows, but somehow he's just letting her go because he's the fucking genius that's always 10 steps ahead, right? But I love those scenes so much precisely for the tension, because they're like being in the theater and just watching actors play out And for me, that's like one of my favorite things when you can translate that to the cinema successfully.
Yeah,
when they, I agree with everything you said. I just think, yeah, could have been shorter. But and they could have achieved pretty much all of that. It's just a long fucking movie, and it feels long. And I just like Django in every facet more. And that movie had scenes that moved, was still just as funny, still had just as much virtuosic performances. Yeah, we should just talk about that movie some more. Well, you mentioned Hans Landa. Let's talk about him. Unless Lux, you had something to say about that.
Oh well, I have a lot to say about Hans Landa, so let's get to that.
Yeah. So one of the things I like the most about him is that just how polite he is and how good his manners are. And I think, and you brought this up, Austin, a little bit in the Django podcast about how one of the most terrifying parts of Nazi Germany is that the myth is that they were the zenith of culture at the time, and that people, even people who knew Beethoven and could, I mean, not literally knew Beethoven, but people who were ingratiated in the culture that spat out Beethoven, and I know Mozart was from Austria, but that same thing, that they could basically be as disgusting as they are. So there's all these really great parts where he's overly polite. Mm. So he says to the guy at the beginning, since this is your house, I ask permission to switch to English. Can I smoke my pipe? And he's like, please, this is your house. Or I'm sorry, the French guy says, can I smoke my pipe? He even knows Italian, which even Von Hammersmark says, Germans are not good at Italian. There's no way they're going to know. Mm. And he, of course, as the very cultured, very smart, very acute detective, does speak Italian. And
well, because he's not, he's not a Nazi in the way that people want to portray him as, like this evil barbarian, right? He's literally opposite. He says, I'm a detective. He's like, so of course, when this happens, I'm going to do my job. I'm just going to do it under a new rubric, right? Like, that's his thing. We're meant to believe that he is kind of this morally upstanding guy, which is what makes the Aldo bit at the end all the more satisfying, maybe. It's kind of like, so you are this rational, refined gentleman who is learned, who's a detective, who has rational capacities to the hilt, and yet I still can't let you go for the atrocities that you've participated in.
Right. That's part of what makes this movie so effective, I think, is that it, much like my father, has no time for the good Nazi, right? Like, you have Friedrich Zoller, who's polite and well-behaved and respectful up until the last part where he becomes sort of like a weird incel. But otherwise, he's like pretty
That's
cool
what
most
I thought
of the
too, dude.
Yeah, otherwise, he's like pretty cool most of the time. And then you have, you know, Hans Landa, who's, as Austin described him, is like this very precise, like detective, genius, wizard man. But the movie never forgives either of them for being fucking Nazis. It's like, The movie at no point is like, well, you are pretty good at being a detective, Hans. Like, he gets the punishment he deserves, which is, I think, a really strong part of the movie, is that it has, like, a lot of Tarantino movies, as you kind of said before, Jared, don't have a clear ethical compass built into the style and the construction of the movie. And this movie does, even if it's the very simple one of, like, Nazis are very bad.
Yeah, but I feel like it's more vague than Django. I think Django is probably the most clear-cut one, because all of the white slavers are characterized as these doofuses who are parading as these great intellectuals. But in this, Landa is a smart, very capable, very intelligent guy. And does he get his comeuppance? I mean, he gets sweet land on Nantucket Island, and yeah, he's got a scar, but, you know, I'm sure he can just wear a hat or something.
Well, and it's not
I
just
don't know.
Landa.
Whereas Django ends in an explosion of, and literally everyone dies.
Okay, so I think there's two things on that. One, the first part you said, that's just Hannah Arendt, right? Like, that's the banality of evil. Yeah, Eichmann could play the piano. Like, that's the whole thing. They were super cultured, super smart guys, but they were ethically irredeemable. And the movie is very much in lockstep with Hannah Arendt on that question, on the banality of evil, right? Like, they could be as cool, like, they could all be like rad dudes in Hawaiian shirts with surfboards and sunglasses, and they still wouldn't be cool because, like, they're fucking Nazis, right? And that's what the movie wants you to take away from it. And Django is making, like, a much more decisive, like, everyone dies at the end thing. But I think that part of the, you know, message of the movie is, like, you know, Landas are around. Like, they're hiding. Like,
I guess I'm just arguing that Django is more cathartic because not only are these people evil, but they're a bunch of fucking stooges, whereas these guys are evil, but they're also really smart, which look, I'm not saying that it's offending me in any way. I just don't find it as fun to watch.
For sure. I just think that's the critique of Nazism, though. I don't think they could make it, you know, if they'd done it a different way, everyone would have been
That's
not what the deal is. Nazis were like geniuses, but evil.
Right.
Do you think that he kind of even accentuates this by setting it up that kind of, because the American guys are kind of dumb, right?
Yeah.
Like, Aldo's kind of dumb. Obviously, Von Hammersmark, the running joke in Europe, and this is the case if you're in Europe, is that Americans are kind of dumb and that Europeans are educated, right? She's like, do any of you, she's like, I hesitate to even ask this because I already know the answer. Do any of you happen to know another language other than American? You know? And it's like, well, of course not. So I read this interesting piece a while ago, and I can't even remember who it was, but I will never forget this phrase. It was that this film sets up, you have the Nazis on one side, because it's not just Landa either. It's also August Diehl's character in the basement, who is the SS character who calls out Michael Fassbender's inappropriate three. That scene also shows how intelligent he is as an investigator, mm-hmm. because he knew the game that he was playing with the King Kong thing on his head. And that sets up for us to understand that he is an extremely intelligent and kind of perspicuous kind of thinker, right? And so there's this clear dichotomy between the Nazis who are portrayed as, you know, and then even the guy who's celebrating the birth of his son, he's a good guy, quote unquote, right? Like, he just wants to go home to his family. And then there's the kid that points out where all the Nazis are at one point, and he says he wants to go hug his mom. Like, you know, there's a humanity there and a rationality that characterizes the Nazis, whereas the Americans are kind of, as this article said, barbarians for the good. And that it accentuates this dichotomy, because it doesn't matter if they're rational or if they're the ones who want to hug their families. If they're quote-unquote animals or barbarians for the good, it doesn't matter, because they're still for the good. And that kind of accentuates this dichotomy even more.
No, totally. I think that that's exactly right. That, like, basically, it almost is making the argument that, like, as much intellectual energy as you want to put into justifying something like Nazism, it's unjustifiable and irredeemable, much in the same way as it takes zero intellectual effort to make the argument that it's bad. Right? Like, I don't need to do any digging to be like, you shouldn't gasp children.
Do you think that it's because he's making a statement not about, like, morality per se and, like, feel goods, but rather justice? And so even though they're, like, not, like, the family types and they're not, like, the nice ones, they still stand for what's right, ultimately. You think that's the point?
Yeah, I think maybe so, that there is sort of, like, that it wants you to take the role of justice. And what I like about this movie in that respect, as a viewer, is, like, and maybe this, I'll put the caveat, may be very specific to me, but, like, the end of the movie is almost begging you to feel bad for the Nazis. They're, like, trying to escape this burning room and just getting gunned down. And, like, I don't have it in me to feel bad in that moment. Like, I'm reveling in that. And I think
that's the best part of the movie
is trying to see, like, how far it can, like, go, like, how far it can push you to make you feel bad for these people. And, like, kind of to do, like, the Starship Troopers-y complicity thing in a much smaller way. But I think that it does, like, it wants you to be like Nazis were human. They had brains. They made choices. They were still Nazis. Like, even despite all the reasons why one would never do a thing like that, they all did it.
So back to what Austin was saying about justice, I think I would say no to that, because the bastards are never motivated by justice. They're motivated by revenge. And the movie is very clear about that, that this is just about, it's just about brutality.
Yeah. Well, that's part of my problem, I would say, with the moral framework of this film, is that it's about,
for the first time, I'm kind of with you on that. Yeah, because if they're not smarter than the Germans, if the Germans aren't exposed to be these dunces that we're smarter than, and if we're not being more ethical than them either, if we're just meeting brutality with brutality, then I mean, what do we have here?
I mean, not Nazis. Like, that's why that's the thing. I think that's, like, very important in this movie and in the movie cinematic language and, like, the ethical framing of the movie, is that, like, there's no ethical or moral or even sort of justice-y framework in which fucking the Third Reich was an acceptable thing, right? And so it doesn't require, you don't have to prove that, like, oh, these soldiers figured out that actually a Holocaust is bad. Like, we know that going in, right? And so does the audience, and so do the bastards and all that shit. And I think it very much is about justice, because, like, at a certain point, like, Old Testament-style retributive justice is a thing.
Yeah.
And like a lot of revenge movies are about the sort of distinction between revenge and justice. And I don't think this movie draws that distinction. I think it sees them as the same thing.
Yeah.
And which is totally fine in some contexts, like this one.
Could you see an adequate exploration of this type of event, the Nazi event, let's say, but within a different framework of justice that isn't retributive, that's more like compensatory or rehabilitative or restorative justice? Because I know this is one of the issues that I think is kind of really cutting through the cultural discourse at the moment, is that it seems like retributive justice is something that the left has historically been opposed to, but is now embracing fully with cancel culture and call out culture and things like that, right? That's really an eye for an eye kind of thing. It's like, no, well, fuck you. Men have had positions of power for years, so fuck you. It's time for your comeuppance. And while I don't necessarily think there's something wrong with that impulse, what I wonder is there something interesting about how the left has like just wholeheartedly embraced retribution? And then how when we look at a film like this, it's a celebration of retribution. Is there a way to kind of think about this in a more complex framework?
I think so. I think that part of that is just a calculation of like metaphorical distance, I guess, between two points, if that makes sense. Like the call-out culture of like, actually this movie is a really good example of that, right? Like the call-out culture that exists now is a lot of like problems distinguishing between representation and endorsement and stuff like that. And also is like a very knee-jerky reaction to things that maybe are much more easily dealt with sort of conversationally or rehabilitationally. But there is a certain point at which like, well, I think that we can sort of be like, you're decidedly bad and we should get rid of you. And like that point is Nazis for me.
Mm.
I don't know if that's true for everyone. Maybe it should be. But like, if like that's like basically up to Nazi, I'm willing to have a conversation.
Right.
But that's sort of my bright line cutoff. And I think that's sort of like, I don't think, and again, this is very much a me watching this movie in 2019 thing, but like, I think that's where the movie is sort of, is that like, there's a line, right? There's a line of like exploitative power relation and force, an asymmetrical force that is like over, that is beyond the pale. And that's what they're reacting to. Same as Django. And those things are, I think, are real. And I think that call-out culture and stuff like that does make the mistake of thinking that that's everything. Which it's decidedly not. And I think that that's the issue of call-out culture, at least for me, as like an active leftist, is like, look, I get that maybe there's a way to think about me calling you stupid as ableist, but like, I just think that your ideas are bad. Like, you know what I mean? This is the thing. That's me referencing a conversation I had on the internet recently. But like, I think that like there's better uses of like political time than that. Whereas I think that their retributive justice, I think, is warranted and doesn't need to be overcomplicated in the context of something like this.
Well, I don't want to say, so we were mentioning earlier that the Germans are just shown as regular people. They love movies like we do. They have children. They get drunk like we do. But that's not entirely the case. I mean, there are some pot shots taken at some German figures, like the whole Goebbels thing with him. There's like that shot where he very quickly is like sexually abusing his assistant or something like that.
Just having like and weird, creepy sex.
Having weird, creepy sex. There's a whole thing where he freaks out when Melanie Laurent mentions a particular German actress. Right, who I guess renounced the Reich and moved out of Germany.
Yeah.
And even when Hitler is watching the movie, that's probably one of the best parts about this, is that the movie that is made about Zoller's life is like totally ham-fisted and cheesy, and Hitler's just there laughing his ass off, having a grand old time, just looking really gross with his laughter. So they are taking the piss out of the Germans to an extent.
They roast the ever-loving shit out of Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but I just don't think it's as effective or as clever as Django.
Well, they have this one scene that stands out for me Hitler-wise where he's like this like looking like a fucking goblin in his office, and then someone's painting him behind him looking like a regal general, but then he's like right in front, like hunched over and sweaty and like looking like me if I forget where my cigarettes went. And it's like like a really good bit at the expense of Hitler, that is like, and they roast Hitler mercilessly, which is very funny because they do present a lot of the Germans, like the Germans on the ground, as like, well, we said sort of smart and dignified, but Hitler himself is kind of a joke, which is a weird thing for the movie to do, but also very funny and effective.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so real quick, you guys mentioned in passing Hans eating the strudel, And I want to focus on that scene a little bit, because I agree, I quite like that scene a lot. And there's the very, very extreme close-up of the cream being put on the strudel and Melanie Laurent eating it and then Hans Landa eating it. And then he puts the cigarette out on the strudel after telling her that, oh man, you have to wait for the cream because it's going to be so, so good. Mm. What do you guys put any thought into that?
Yeah, actually, I wrote a little thing that I will not read because it's in my garbled shorthand, but I was writing out some ideas about the dairy imagery in the movie because it's persistent.
Like dairy imagery.
Like Hans
Go
Landa
on,
is
sir.
Like constantly doing, is engaged with dairy stuff. He drinks the milk. There's the cream thing. Mm-hmm. I think there's another reference later. Like dairy is a real thing for him. And for me, doing a little bit of research, dairy often symbolizes one of two things in sort of narrative, which is either purity or conflict. And so, right, because purity, it's like milk is very wholesome, right? It symbolizes home. It comes from farms. It's like the thing that we all drink when we're kids. It's pure white, which obviously is a loaded connotation, but is one that we've sort of, Western art has sort of codified as pure. And then conflict, obviously, because it represents sort of like material wealth in like an agrarian society, right? If you have a farm and you can have milk, you're doing pretty good. And so I really like him putting out the cigarette in the cream as foreshadowing of his betrayal of the Reich later, right? Like, he's not ideologically aligned with Nazis. He's just doing it, as Austin said before, because it's a job for a detective to do. So his concern for, like, purity as represented by the cream is, like, doesn't really actually matter that much. He's throwing the cigarette in it. And you can sort of see that transition from sort of the performative Jew hunter Landa at the beginning, who loves the purity, chugs it, and has a borderline orgasm, as Austin said, chugging the purity juice. Later, he puts a cigarette out in it. At the end, he even says that the name Jew Hunter is not one he's particularly proud of, when earlier in the movie, he said he was very proud of it because he'd earned it. So I think it's sort of foreshadowing that transition away from being sort of Jew Hunter Landa into being, the traitor Landa.
But did that surprise you? Because although everything you're saying makes sense, and yes, even in that scene, the initial scene, he says how I disagree with the Reich's depiction of the rat as a Jew, and as the Jew as a rat, and here's why. But even still, when he decides to defect at the end, I'm surprised. Did you guys feel similarly?
I was surprised, but not. But only because that's just something we don't expect in any sort of Nazi movie, right? You don't really think that that's... And because it's a total revision of history, so you're like, where the fuck is this movie going? Oh my God, Hitler's face just got shot to shit. Like, so in that sense, yeah, I was surprised. But I think I think Lux is absolutely right. I'd never actually thought about the putting the cigarette out in the cream as sort of like the midway point of his development, let's say, towards him kind of not really caring about the purity of the ideology of Nazism, but rather he is kind of this greater Landa, that he is more than the Jew hunter, that he is a wise, intelligent human being by his own estimation, right? I hadn't thought of that before. But so when you think about the totality of his development, no, it doesn't seem surprising at all. It actually seems totally fine that he thinks that he's just going to be able to, once this war is over, he's going to be able to take his skills and apply them in a different context, and that his guilt should not be attributed to him as a person, but rather to a matter of circumstance, and that he should be absolved because of that ultimately.
Yeah, I think that's...
But didn't this all happen before D-Day? And at that point, it's not like the Germans were really losing to... They weren't losing yet, so why would he make that deal? It didn't really make a lot of sense to me.
Opportunist.
Yeah, I think that you have a higher... Like, there's... stay on one side and risk the war, which is a toss-up, going your way, or there's ensure it ends one way and you get a prize.
Hitler does say that the Americans are on the beach in an earlier talk.
Oh, I read somewhere that the last scene happens either on D-Day or right after D-Day or something like that. I was reading an article about the film, so I actually don't know.
Okay.
If that's right.
Yeah, but I think that it's more just like, you know, he's controlling all the variables, right? If he does it this way, he's totally in control of the outcome, except for Aldo Rain, which he thinks he's in control of. Whereas the other way, there's all kinds of variables that he can't account for. So this way he, like, has a sure shot to, like, retirement on the beach, which I guess is what he wants.
Yeah, he's not politically principled. He's like, scientifically principled, you know?
Yeah, that's actually a really good way to put it, because one of my notes is... quote, I didn't realize that Hans Landa was an object-oriented philosopher.
Mm.
But he is. And I guess maybe I should do a top level explanation of what that sentence I just said means.
Please.
But so object-oriented philosophy, to do it really quickly, is based on sort of programming language and thinking about the way that we interact with computers and the way computers interact with objects. And in particular, it draws a lot on Heidegger in the sense of how we interact with and understand a thing to exist, right? Like, for instance, a good example of object-oriented philosophy is when you look at a picture of a unicorn on your computer, what part of our culture and your brain makes you go, oh, it's a unicorn, not, oh, it's a collection of data, or, oh, it's a collection of pixels, or whatever other parts, sort of parts go into that. And it has to do with all kinds of social things. And this guy, Graham Harman, talks about it a lot in the context of the thingness of a thing. And so, for instance, how do we know a thing is a rock? Well, it's hard, but lots of things are hard. How do we know it goes through this process, all this stuff? We don't think about that as soon as we see. If I had to see a rock, I don't go, well, this probably went through thousands of years of sedimentary pressure. There's like an instinct that tells me it's a rock. And Hans Landa's description of the Jew in the beginning of the movie is very much like that, right? He's like, well, it's like a squirrel, but it has this tail. Like a rat's like a squirrel, but has this tail, but you immediately have this revulsion to the rat that you don't have for the squirrel just because of its ratness, the same way that like the Jew looks like a person, but has this Jewness attached to it. And I think that's a really fascinating sort of take on Nazism. I don't think it's entirely intellectually genuine because like, I mean, they were really going around being like, Jews are bad because of a lot of reasons.
Well, but he says that it's not Nazis. It's him.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I don't think it's a good faith indication of Nazism generally, but as like a particular opinion for Hans Landa to have, it makes a lot of sense. And it's a really interesting one to have in the movie because it does sort of have a tangible mysticism to it, like all of kind of Graham Harman and Heidegger's stuff does, where it's like there's a spirit that gives the thing a meaning. I mean, they don't say spirit, but like there's like an ineffable thing.
There's an enduring essence, well
said. Yeah, there's an enduring essence. And that the idea that there's an enduring essence of Jewness is like is both an assumption of sort of Nazism generally, but fleshed out the way Landa does it very different from a lot of the Nazi sort of stuff. It was a very fascinating moment when I had that realization that like his sense of what sort of Nazi anti-Semitism means is different than like most Nazis, which is cool and interesting and a fun twist on this character who's really cool because he's like he's not like the other Nazis.
But he's not a good Nazi, which brings me to my last question. And this is mostly targeted towards Lux, but really either one of you. How would you feel differently about the movie if they had killed Landa at the end versus etched the swastika into his forehead?
Yeah, I would have had Shoshana kill Landa and Aldo Raine dies.
No, I mean if Aldo Raine just shoots him in the head and then the movie ends. That would, he surrenders, gives him his gun back. He just shoots both of them and then the movie ends.
That would have been fine by me also. Like I said, my issue with the ending, and I think part of where it gets ethically ambiguous, is that I think Raine should have died, Shoshana should have lived. It's a weird, weird, weird choice that they did the opposite. I don't understand it.
Why do you think that?
Because Shoshana's like the victim of, like the living victim living in her victimization of this situation. And so her story is about like taking charge of her life and like taking charge of like being a Jew and exerting what little power she has as a Jew in Nazi-occupied France. And then she dies.
But it's ultimately because of her that the mission, I mean, she still ends the war.
Yes, no, totally. No, totally, totally, totally. But I think that if, like, for instance, I think that your sort of ethical qualm with this movie, Jared, about like the we're meeting brutality with brutality, I think if the movie ends with Raine dead and her alive, that qualm no longer holds up. Because then it's like the sort of machine of like counter death gets destroyed because we don't need it anymore. It's over. Whereas like the rebellious sort of people who are oppressed acting up against those oppressors can define the framework of like their new life in a new world without those oppressors. It's like a much more sort of hopeful, productive ending. Whereas this one is like, well, the hopeful character's dead and the killing guy's around, I guess. And I think that sends a very different sort of a little bit more nihilistic message than if I were making this movie, I would be happy to do.
Well, from like a mythical framework though, she dies. And maybe this is just a limitation of our mythical logic, our mythical capacities, is that she dies and then she becomes a sort of cinematic god. Like Shoshana, like we said earlier, we fell in love with Melanie Laurent from this film, right? And I think part of the reason is because of the way that she dies with this orchestral, like sentimental music and like flowers like burst out of her, or like sparkles or something burst out of her when she's shot, right? There's almost like this Holy Spirit releasing because she's like the Messiah that releases upon the lands and her blood literally goes into the earth and redeems the cosmos in a way, which is that sort of mythical idea of human sacrifice where the blood would go in and magically transform the order and make it harmonious again. So maybe that there's a problem with the entire mythical structure that we can't think beyond that. And this makes me think of like René Girard and the idea of the scapegoat, right? Is that he says you have to have this kind of like Christian idea of the scapegoat, which is a sort of mediator of peace rather than the sort of mediator of sacrifice of like mimetic rivalry, which sort of changes the mythical framework. And maybe Tarantino just can't think beyond a particular framework of mythological thinking. Maybe.
Well, hold on. I think there's an important thing to add to that, and that is that even though she dies, the image of her that ultimately everyone sees as they're dying is an image of her saying that you are killed by a Jew. She's no longer in the kind of red star of Hollywood vamp clothing. She's dressed. I believe she even has. I'm a horrible Jew right now. What is the thing over your hair that like
a yarmulke or whatever?
It wasn't a yarmulke, but the thing that the girls wear. Isn't she wearing something like that? She's dressed all in black.
That's an Orthodox Jewish person thing, not my bag.
Okay, me neither. Sorry, but anyway, the image of her that ultimately lives past her death and effects change is the image of her explicitly as a Jew, at least through what she says.
Yeah, that's true. And I like that. And I also like how they do the part where she's projected on smoke. That looks cool as hell.
Yes, so cool.
Yeah, fuck
yeah, for sure. She almost comes out like a spirit, right?
Yeah, no, it feels very spiritual in that moment. And that's why that's why I don't have like a problem with the ending per se, because I think everything y'all are saying is right. I just think that the sort of ethical ambiguity the movie sort of inadvertently traffics in is largely a result of the way they do the ending. I just don't think that it doesn't feel as much like it's not as optimistic. It's like, well, which maybe is fine. Maybe in that case, Tarantino was right. He was like, well, land is alive and we still need Nazi hunters. And like, 10 years later, to that. Maybe he's smarter than I'm giving him credit for. But like, to me, it feels a little bit, a little nihilistic in a way that a lot of the movie doesn't feel. A lot of the movie, the movie feels, maybe again, it's the Jewish boy thing, but like this movie feels really aspirational because in media, like we have Jews in media, but a lot of times they're either like sneaky or smart or clever or like get by being funny. They don't get by being like fucking badasses with guns. And shit like that. Like that's not what Jews in media do. And so like a lot of this movie feels very cathartic and aspirational to me as like a, Jewish dude, but that ending doesn't quite line up to that feeling, which maybe again is like, that's because that feeling wasn't like the root of the thing he's going for or whatever.
See, I wanted to go into the movie and have that same cathartic experience, but what I wanted more than anything was I just wanted more time with the bastards. We only got to see one Nazi killed with a baseball bat.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
Great failure of the movie.
I would have rathered to it have been like a Seven Samurai type ensemble film where we get to know all the bastards. We see them killing a lot more Nazis. That was, frankly, another reason why I like Django more, is because we follow two characters. We follow them the whole way. There's a clear protagonist, which is this one. There's chapters. We're always going between different people. And there's a lot more talking than there is killing.
Yeah, and I mean, to be totally frank, one thing with this movie that I both love and drives me nuts is that if you were to five-act this movie, it wouldn't line up the fucking chapters.
Yeah.
Like, the chapters aren't act markers, which is infuriating.
Yeah. All right, guys, we're going to head into the mailbag, unless you guys have anything else to say about this movie. I will say that I think the best thing that we've said today, really interesting, is Lux saying how new media proved Tarantino wrong. I find that very clever.
I have one more thing I want to say from my notes that I'm really into, if you guys don't mind.
Yeah, go for it.
I think the juxtaposition of Zoller and Landa is really cool. Because Landa understands the social and physically dangerous implications of every single thing he does at every single moment. Using the milk to taunt Shoshana, or when he's talking to Aldo and doing the Italian accent thing.
Wait,
in the theater,
think,
everything
you
like
don't
that.
Think
he's
that was an accident
of the power relation and the language and how he's manipulating those things. Whereas Zoller like literally never is. Like Zoller is constantly ignorant of like the implicit power relation of him talking to Shoshana and all that stuff. And it shows this cool comparison of like how both knowingly and unknowingly, people in positions of power can manipulate and use that power to exploit others who aren't. And how even if you're thinking about it, you're a big asshole like Landa, but even if you're like a nice seeming boy like Zoller, you might just do it all the time anyways. And I think that's a really interesting and sort of 2019 woke examination of privilege that I cannot imagine was on purpose. At least not
Wait,
in those
you
terms.
Think you think that Landa knew who Shoshana was and gave her the milk to fuck with her head?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh,
right?
I think so for sure.
Yeah, big time.
Oh, see, I don't.
Oh, really? Yeah, I thought so.
I think
for
that
sure.
was just a coincidence.
That bit when he says there was one more thing and then there's a close up on his face. And I think that obviously Tarantino's playing with the audience expectation as well.
But yeah, definitely that.
I think that Landa for sure knows. I think we're meant to think that he knows everything.
Yeah, I think so, because he's like a fucking amoral Lucifer figure.
But doesn't he find out right then and there that they're changing where the movie is going to be premiering? So if we were to think that he has this master plan in his head of knowing exactly what the Americans are going to try to do to the movie theater, and that's how he's going to bargain his way to a luxurious life in America, it doesn't even make sense at that point.
Oh, no. He's an opportunist. He's adapting to the situation as it presents itself as being very
Well, then I'm just saying that if he saw her, who's clearly a Jew, he would have just said something immediately. He would have no reason not to, especially if his bosses, like Goebbels, are right there in front of him and he can get, as you said, he's an opportunist. He can get a lot of brownie points with Goebbels by saying, hey, by the way, this woman at your table right now is a Jew. Let me kill her for you.
Yeah, but he kind of lets her go in the opening scene to kind of maybe indicate that there's a supposed quote unquote benevolence about him, right?
When he says
au revoir, Shoshana. He's not supposed to be like this evil, I'm going to kill Jews when I see them. Again, he's doing his job. He's calculative.
He has no, to take a page out of Austin's zone of expertise, he has no libidinal investment in Jew killing. Like, he doesn't.
He's libidinally invested in his scientific endeavors.
Right, and in his expertise in general.
Yes.
But Jew killing as a behavior is not something that he's, like, particularly about. It's just that that's what he's doing right now. But if he, like, runs into a Jewish girl at a fucking bakery... a bakery that the movie tells us is in Paris, but is actually in Berlin, which I find very funny. Like, why, you know, what does he give a shit?
All right. Well, give us an email if you guys agree with them or me as to whether or not Landa knew at the time. movies@wisecrack.co. And without further ado, let's go into the mailbag. So first of all, we got a lot of great emails about Us. I think that's a movie that really has engaged people. And have either of you two seen it?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, cool. So we can all add into the conversation about this. So let's start with some voicemails. Let's start with Zach. Go. Oh, by the way, if you want to send us voicemail, 213-534-8807 or 21ElfGut07. Let's start with Zach.
ElfGut
Go
gets
Zach.
Me every time.
Hey, Wisecrack. This is Zach from Texas calling for the Us podcast. I'm in the middle of listening to it, but I hear a lot of discussion about the rabbits and Michael Jackson. Just wanted to lend my thoughts. The rabbits are known to be burrowing creatures, similar to the tunnels mentioned. And Michael Jackson is kind of mentioned as a symbol in horror films. Sorry. Because in the advertising, you see Lupita Nyong'o with one glove, and Michael Jackson is known for one glove. They also make reference to OJ and Freddy Krueger, who also are known for one glove. We see this in a lot of horror films, where certain symbols show what's coming in the film. That might be what they're going for. I just wanted to say then, see what you guys thought. Thanks. Bye.
Well, thanks for calling in, Zach. We got a lot of great emails, too, about the rabbits in particular. But what do you guys think about that? And did you guys have any alternate takes on the rabbits or the glove?
Well, rabbits-wise, I can tell you I messaged everyone's favorite Alec and said, hey, I'm listening to the Us episode, Show Me the Meaning, and what the fuck, y'all talked about Us and not mention Alice in Wonderland or Through the Looking Glass one goddamn time?
Well, no, hey, we did that in our video that Burns
did. It is in the video. It was so apparent to me from the opening shot. I was like, oh, rabbit, this is going to be an Alice in Wonderland film.
Yeah, fucking pins Lupita Nyong'o's face to the mirror, like the moment before we start getting revelations about the world and we see the reflection. Like, I think
through,
all that stuff is,
glass,
is very much Through the Looking Glass, Alice in Wonderland coded with the same ideas of Alice in Wonderland stuff, that there's like a world, an interior world we don't see or understand about ourselves. And obviously there's the class and race implications, like Peele is taking it more towards the sense that there's an internalized world of like internalized depression, stuff like that. And obviously like there before the grace of God go I-ism. But I think it is very supposed to be like Alice in Wonderland, fantastical. It was a signal that, like, where you are when you follow the rabbit is not, like, real in the sense of, like, you know, it's a heightened reality. It's different there.
It's also interesting that the opening shot focuses on the white rabbit, and then as it pulls out, you see scattered brown rabbits periodically.
But mostly white rabbits.
What's that?
But mostly white rabbits.
But mostly white rabbits. Yeah, I mean, it's. I mean, I wonder if it's even mathematically like 13% of the population, which would be have been a really nice touch. But regardless, the point is that there's a white rabbit, and then there's a minority of non-white rabbits. And I think that that's something that's interesting, because obviously the Alice in Wonderland story is following the white rabbit. And there's this notion of time and temporality and things like that that are also like this – creating this urgency that's involved in this as well. And I think that all needs to be considered in the symbolism of the white rabbit.
Yeah, for sure, the sense of urgency and the sense of like the path to self-discovery, right? Like the white rabbit's like the chauffeur to Katabasis, I guess, is like a fun way to say it. You know, like she goes into the cave to find the knowledge of self, the classic like Greek trope. And in so many stories, the white rabbit or white rabbit surrogate is what takes you into the cave to find the truth. And that's what happens in this movie too.
Yeah. When she's going down the tunnel.
Yeah. When she's going down the tunnel and talking to everyone, or not talking to everyone, but seeing everything, then talking to herself.
Mm-hmm. All right, cool. Let's go to another voicemail from Eric. Go, Eric.
Hi, Wisecrack. This is Eric calling from Hawaii. I just saw Us myself, and I really liked the movie, and I enjoyed your guys' takes on it in the podcast. I wanted to remind you that you touched on the rabbits, but you didn't really go into too much detail on it. I think the white rabbit is definitely a symbol tied to Adelaide. So, again, I don't know much about it. I know the rabbits were used for food in the underground, but other than that, I don't know what else it stands for. So if you can elaborate on that, I'd appreciate it. But I also wanted to touch that this is very much the most unique and interesting take on an apocalypse movie. I can imagine everyone in the world after the tethered come from the underground to the above ground, they'll be like, where were you that day that Hands Across America became a reality? And it's just very interesting. I don't know if Jordan Peele will do this, but I'd be very interested to see another movie take place post Us, where, you know, it's after they still have the whole string of tethered in the red jumpsuit stretching across America. Does that divide America? Like, are you able to get through the line that's dividing America, the line created by all the people in red? So I think it's very interesting, like, the circumstances at the end of this movie created. So if you have any other thoughts on that, I'd like to hear it. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Eric. Well, we just talked about the rabbits, and actually, let's talk about his second point, because there are some emails that talk more about the rabbits that we can get into in a sec.
Jeez.
People yeah, I mean,
fucking horny for rabbits.
I know everyone is horny for rabbits. I mean,
I guess it's because it's one thing that we glaringly omitted in our podcast or something.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I guess I yelled at Alec about it.
I tweeted that Us is the coolest Jesus film I've seen since The Wrestler. And
oh, go on.
You did tweet that.
I did tweet that. And I'm obsessed with mythology, and obviously I was training to be a pastor, and then I have a master's degree in theology. So, like, I'm obsessed with how the Jesus trope and myth is reproduced in all of these various different guises and contexts. It's something that we just can't seem to get away with. And part of it's because it has a rich mythic tradition itself that it follows in, right? You know, Isis and Osiris and various other sort of myths from around the history of human anthropology. But I think that this is a really weird and interesting inversion of a particular theological theme that's known as Jesus the Victor. And it's the idea that when Jesus dies on the Friday, he goes down into hell and he proclaims victory, and he actually kind of like battles with the devil in hell, in Hades, and then releases the souls of the previously dead that were in Abraham's bosom. And so this idea that Jesus is, you know, he's a savior, he's a king, he's a priest, he's a prophet, all these other things, but Jesus the Victor is really interesting. And I think you see this with her as well, with Lupita's character. And then it kind of gets inverted at the end, because really the victor isn't the real quote-unquote human, but it's kind of just a matter of circumstances, who it is that's been kind of brought up into the light that can then go down and kind of release the souls. But there's this sense of like releasing the souls, and that there's no longer this bifurcation between the shadows and the real anymore. And there's no longer this distinction, but rather everything is kind of released into the free. And so it's like a weird, chaotic Jesus the Victor kind of apocalyptic story. I just thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, it is really interesting. I didn't read it as an apocalypse thing, only because, like, so one of the things I loved about this movie, and there's a lot, I fucking adored this fucking movie.
Me too.
Yeah, I thought it was so good. Oh my God. But one thing I really liked about it is that, like, the fucking tethered, like, their plan fucking sucks. Like, it's a shitty, stupid plan invented by a child. And, like, you can tell, right? Like, all they are doing is, like, we're going to come up, kill our copies, and then we're all going to hold hands. Like, the end, right? Like, it's, and then, like, you know, like, fucking, like, Jethro Tull listening gun nuts are just going to, like, come out of their bunkers and, like, shoot the Hands Across America. Like, with guns, which they don't have. Like, that's the thing is, like, it's not a sustainable plan. It doesn't feel like an apocalypse to me, but it does feel like a really cool, like, it opens up, like, this, like, world of, like, who was building this shit underground or whatever, or all the stuff that I am not necessarily interested in finding out, but, like, it does raise these cool questions of, like, how the world reacts to that moment. I don't think that moment's, like, apocalyptic per se, but it is, like, clearly a moment in history that would be very interesting to see how, like, the world reckons with.
Yeah, it's an event.
Yeah, for sure. Capital E, Badoo-style event.
Exactly, yeah. And that, and really, like, not to get too semantic here, but the word apocalypse that Badiou derives, he actually derives it from Sartre's use of the apocalypse in Critique of Dialectical Reason. Badiou says as much. And Sartre derives it from Malraux in a novel where it's talking about, like, these things that happen when you hope against hope, or these things that kind of transform a world that kind of seemingly come from nowhere. And so it's this idea that it's about something that emerges and disrupts our framework, and then we have to decide how it is that we're going to respond to it. Because the word apocalypse from, like, the biblical tradition just means, like, a revealing or an appearing. So the apocalypse of John, the book of Revelation, is the revelation of the event of the return of the Messiah or the manifestation of the kingdom. And so that's why I think all of this kind of fits into this weird sort of Jesus the victor kind of story that's super mythological, and I found it to be so gripping because of that. Because it's like, okay, now what? Like, I want to know what happens next, just like the caller said, you know? And I think Lux said it too. It's like, what happens after this event?
Yeah, because boy, that game, that all right, has no end game.
So I want to go into the mailbag. So shoot us an email at movies@wisecrack.co. We got an email from Jake, which I think is quite interesting, and I want to start with this one because I think he mirrors a lot of the criticisms I've seen of this movie, and particularly the criticism that Ryan had with the movie. So he says, I have some shit to say about Us. Mainly, I think Peele really missed the mark with his use of symbolism and reincorporation in this film. Many of you spoke about how detail-oriented the film was, and although I agree with that, I feel it was at the expense of the story itself. In Stephen King's book On Writing, he compares crafting a story to uncovering a fossil. The whole of the fossil is already there, and it's the writer's job to dig it up piece by piece. Symbolism, he says, functions in the same way. You can't just cram it in after the fact. It needs to be discovered or uncovered organically, lest to be heavy-handed and obtuse. I think any filmmaker could make a biblical verse that symbolically represents their film and cram references of it into their film left, right, and center. This doesn't make it good. It just makes it have more biblical references. This movie at times feels more like an Easter egg hunt than a story. I don't care about the symbolic murder weapons when I don't feel like anything is at stake for the main characters. The horror and comedy both fell flat because of this. Furthermore, I don't think you can hope for your film to be subtle or intentionally vague when you backload it so heavily with exposition the way Us did with Red's monologue on the nature and origin of the doubles. My personal philosophy with genre films is that it's always much more interesting that something crazy is happening than knowing why that crazy thing is happening. I appreciate subtlety and symbolism, but I think Peele missed the mark here. I felt like he couldn't decide between scope or subtlety and just ended up with a mess. You know, Jacob was telling me, so Jacob went to go see the movie with Bradless and Greg, and he said that he went to the bathroom after the movie, and there was a guy in the bathroom who was just like, am I the only one who just kind of thought that wasn't very good? And apparently there were a lot of people in general agreement. Oh, yeah. And just from people that I've been talking to, I think a lot of people are feeling this way. And maybe it's just because Get Out was one of those movies that was so fun to analyze. People went into this movie knowing that they would have to put on their analytical hat, and when they were assaulted with so many seemingly deliberate symbols, it kind of took them out of it. It was very fun for me. I like putting on that detective hat, but what do you guys think?
That is the one weakness of the movie, is that the story itself and the symbols he uses are all really powerful and compelling, but the movie, and by virtue of how the symbols are used, is constantly being like, think very hard about this. And it's a movie with a story and a set of symbols that you don't need to think that hard about to figure out. And so the movie kind of overcomplicates itself and, like, forces a level of analysis that, like, it's not designed to endure. And I think that that is the one fuck up. Like, This movie's fucking gorgeous. It's beautifully directed. It's incredibly well acted. The sound design's incredible. The story's compelling. The home invasions are great. I think the message about, like, the there before the grace of God go I thing is very powerful and poignant. But unlike Get Out, it's not like you can sit down and be like, this is a movie about X, Y, Z, here's why. In the same kind of way. Like, it's not as straightforward. The message is a little more layered, but not in a way that you need to, like, dig it out or unpack it super far. It's basically just saying, like, in America, cultural problems are always at risk, and for people, especially black folks, that sort of alternate reality where you don't get access to things you have access to is a real fear, and that exists, and it's scary. Like, ultimately, see, that's a lot of it's boiling down to, but it doesn't need to belabor that point as much as it does. I think it's a fucking great movie, but there is a valid criticism that, like, it kind of begs your level of analysis that doesn't need, because the argument is so sort of gettable.
Yeah, I think this movie is pretty graceful with its implementation of the symbolism. If you want a film that goes way over the top on it, go to the first episode of Show Me the Meaning. And what movie was that, Austin?
Mother. I fucking love
Damn
Mother.
Damn right. Fuck that movie.
Yeah, me too. I like that movie too. Me and Austin,
I love
we
it,
get
dude.
It.
Oh, see, I think that movie was all about, there's basically no text here. It's or the subtext is the text, and if you didn't bring your Bible studies book, there's nothing here for you. And I felt like that totally killed the movie.
Yeah, but people get so fucking weird in that movie.
I'm glad you mentioned Mother, because the very same reason that I love Mother is part of the reason that I love Us. I think that everything you guys said is right, that Get Out is a better story in the traditional sense of narrative. It's got its social commentary and satire on point. It's tight. It's put together. But this film is mythical. It's biblical. It's goes to, like, the tradition of what humans have been doing for thousands and thousands of years, which is throwing these stories together that are loaded with cultural meaning, that have offshoots that you could talk about for, I mean, you could talk about just the Alice in Wonderland motif for an entire episode. You could talk just about the biblical references for an entire episode. You could talk about the issue of poverty for an entire episode. And for me, that's what's so amazing about this. It's taking all of that and condensing it into 1.5 hour horror film that also has the jumps, that, as Lux said, is brilliantly directed, that also fits really well into the home invasion kind of subgenre within the genre of horror. And so it's much more of a traditional horror film as well, with the jump scares and things like that. So I think that this is a brilliant package, and that's why I love this movie so much.
The way I've described the difference between this and Get Out to my friends is that Get Out's a better argument, but this is a better movie.
Ooh, I like that.
Like, Get Out's making something, saying something much more nuanced, much more honestly, kind of like broad scale, significant in the sense of, like, it's criticizing, like, the position of whiteness in a way that, like, which means it speaks to sort of the world in a way that, like, Us kind of, its deepest message is very much about the black experience, which is still extremely valuable, but not as directly, like, outward face. It's much more interior facing as far as the thematics go, I guess, is what I mean to say. And I think that this is a beautiful movie. I think it's paced better than Get Out. Get Out has some pacing problems. There's some parts where it doesn't look great. Like, it looks like a Blumhouse movie. That's fine. But it does make a much more, like, coherent and specific argument than this movie does, which is sort of making a vague claim about stuff, but in the same way that Austin's saying, that claim and its vagueness allows it to really sumptuous everything up with these, like, meaningful-ass shots and these beautiful moments and shit you can just talk about forever. Which is, like, that's fucking, I don't know, if you're a big old dork, that's super fucking fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, want to blow through some more of these because we got some great ones. So this one's from Brian. Brian clarifies that the sun's magic trick is meant to make a small flame, like it does briefly when they're in the closet. It's explained that the children from the tunnels mirrored playing with toys like their counterparts above, but that their toy was far more dangerous. He likely had a real lighter. I just thought it was a regular lighter. I mean, were you guys confused as to what the magic trick was?
Maybe he had one of those shitty gas station lighters with the safety still on, and the kid had one with the safety off.
Another thing Brian says,
that's why he's got the burns, because that's all I could think of, because, like, he looked like he had one of those shitty gas station lighters, and, like, if you take the safety off those things, they are fucking a torch.
What do you think about the theory, though, that actually that the sun was also reversed?
Oh, did who? Do I have an email of that, or did somebody mention that to me recently?
Why?
Hold on.
What does that
do? I thought, Well, because you know, people love.
Oh, no, that was Greg that said that in the last podcast.
Yeah, Greg did
like
too,
that.
Right? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I've heard that before now from a couple people. I watched some video where someone was saying, you know, the ending of Us Explained, and it was that the son also, the reason that he puts the mask on is that maybe he was the one who was, he also was kind of like one of the original tethered people or something like that. Whereas I just thought that maybe he was a little bit socially awkward because he was a child of a tethered person, and I that's kind of what I thought. And that the mask was a form of protection. And again, there's mythology about the importance of masks. I just finished going through Joseph Campbell's Masks of God. And one of the things he talks about is how you put the mask on your face and it kind of takes away your three-dimensionality. And you sort of become, if you will, the two-dimensional plane that the ghost can speak through or that the spirit can speak through. And so there's something interesting about what a mask can do to anonymize you and to take away your three-dimensionality. And I thought that was kind of in there as well. But
yeah, to me, I just don't see... Jared, you've heard me say this 3,000 times with working on this Game of Thrones thing, but like, I don't see the point of fan theories that don't interact with the thematic structure of the story. Like, I don't see what the kid being from the underground does for the narrative that doesn't already happen.
Yeah, don't even get me started on fan theories. Anyway. Let's talk about last thing Brian says about Michael Jackson's Thriller. He says it's relevant because it ends with the revelation that the evil version of MJ has taken the place of the normal one, which I had not seen Thriller in a while, so that's pretty cool. We got an email from Frank. He says Jason's double Pluto, so that's the kid, the little boy, his double, acts like a dog or an animal. I like this, and I'm not making fun of you, Frank. I think this is cool. I think this parallels how in Disney you have Goofy and Pluto, who are both dogs, but Goofy is human, while Pluto is treated like an animal. Let me know what you think.
Goofy is canonically a cow.
I was going to say that. Wait, canonically? How has that been?
It's like the fucking wiki.
The wiki? Goofy's Someone told me he was a cow recently.
Yeah, I just heard that recently because I have a t-shirt. I actually have a shirt that has a picture of a dog on it that says it's a moral and ethical issue that Goofy is a dog who owns Pluto, another dog, as a pet.
Yeah, I've seen memes like that.
Someone called me out on my shirt and was like, Goofy's a cow.
What? How can Goofy be a cat?
No, a cow.
Oh, a cow. I think you said a cat.
No, like a...
Oh, no. A cow.
He doesn't really look like a cow either.
No.
The Disney character Goofy was modeled after a breed of Scottish cow.
Wow.
According to Snopes.com.
Mind blown.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff about the animality in this as well, you know, because Pluto also, I mean, the boy, you know, he climbs a tree super quickly, and they're kind of the grunting and the noises and stuff like that. There's a sort of like dehumanization, if you will, of the shadow people that is kind of interesting theme to explore.
Wait, this.
So another thing on rabbits that.
Sorry, this Goofy is a dog or cow debate actually goes really deep.
Oh, I'm sure it does. It's the internet. So hold
sorry,
on.
I'm
going to
pull out of this particular hole.
Please.
And get back to what we're doing.
All right. So Evan sent us an email. This is about the rabbits, since I promised some more rabbit stuff. He said, also, I think the rabbits in the film can represent duality in that rabbits like to be active both at dusk and dawn, possibly representing light and dark. Something I hadn't considered.
Me either. Yeah.
I mean,
all right. So this last one, I'm going to do one more email. Let's wrap it up, guys. So this is from, I'm going to fuck this up, Busilis. He said, I thought it was interesting that you talked about class disparity in the movie, mostly because after I watched it, I took nothing of the sort from my viewing. I did not see the clones as people, because with the exception of Lupita's character, they were literally husks with no identity, waiting for mimetic commands or tasks to perform. This led me to see them as less of a destitute social class and more of a reflection on the nihilism growing in America. You can arguably claim that the same nihilism is fueled by how our identities, culture, and values are banalized by capitalism until we are stripped of agency or individual worth. Seeing as how consumerism or being American was a core theme, it left me feeling like the clones and the film were more of a cautionary tale of how American culture threatens to break itself down by making its citizens into drones with no sense of individual purpose. Or maybe the film is saying we already have and it hasn't hit us yet. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Thanks so much for reading this.
Yeah, there's something really interesting when the tethered come up, and what they do is they just like act what it means to be a consumerist American, right? They put on the makeup and You know, there's the bit where Elizabeth Moss is kind of like doing the Vogue in the mirror and how pretty she is, and she's pretending to scream, but there's a performativity there, not in the Butlerian sense, but like there's a performance, this kind of like this she thinks this is how she's supposed to be American, that I think is something that's interesting as well.
Yeah, I think there's that. I think there's also, I mean, in that respect, I think it's a really cool thing where like they're always like approximating the values of their tethered, like, you know, repeat, like the yeah. Tim Heidecker's wife was like very beauty interested and she got the plastic surgery, and then like Elizabeth Moss's the double did the same thing. I don't think that, like, I think the argument the guy's making, Evan, right? Or no, this is Bucellis. Yeah. I think the argument they're making, obviously I'm very sympathetic to arguments about why capitalism is bad. I just don't think it fully holds up, because I think that this is one of those cases where like the desire to abstract capitalism to sort of like an idea beyond people kind of undercut sort of the value of leftist or like Marxist analysis in the first place. Because this is very much a story about like the way in which capital absolutely drones us, but the thing it drones us to is the fact of its own sort of like stratification and our vulnerability to that. Like, I think basically the movie's never scared of like Adelaide or Gabe or anyone turning into the tethered or being replaced by them. They're just scared of them being murdered by them in their vengeance spree. So the fear is never that we're going to become them, but rather that like our worst selves are going to destroy us. And that the only distance we have from that is like this social system that we have that exists that like maybe is not so great. Because
I think I think it's really hard to say that there's no class reading with the hands across America
thing. Right,
I
mean, exactly.
That is like the neon sign pointing to class disparity or problems of poverty, problems of inequality, stuff
like
that.
I mean, and also Jeremiah 11:11 is like all about the sort of like failure of like the, with either the Israelites or the Judeans, whichever ones were being naughty at the time.
But I think Bucellis's argument is a indication that Jordan Peele has succeeded in making what he called a very personal film, where he's trying to construct it in a way that you project, I guess, other divisions or dualities onto the film and you come away with something personal.
Yeah, no, I think that that's a really good way of looking at it. Cause I think that the read is like really smart, indicates a really good close reading. I think it's just sort of a misses the forest for the trees.
Mm. Austin, you got anything before we wrap it up?
I love this movie. I said I think it's actually better than Get Out, and it's because it just hits all of those buttons. The ones that I can't remember who it was that kind of criticized it for being maybe a bit too symbolically rich are the precise reasons why I love this movie. I think maybe in 10 years I'll actually say that Get Out's better. I think Get Out will be better because what Lux said, what did you say, that Get Out's a better argument, but this is a better movie?
Yeah.
Is that what you said? Yeah, I think that that's absolutely right. And so I think the staying power of Get Out might be more socially, politically. But I think as a sort of mythic presentation in cinematic form, Us is absolutely fantastic.
Also, the fucking technique in Us is out of control.
And Lupita is a goddamn genius.
Yeah, she better be nominated for that performance.
Oh,
that
my
was out
God.
Of control.
Yes. Yeah. He can direct actors, because what he did with Daniel Kaluuya, I mean, not to say that actors don't have skill outside of direction, but direction really matters and script really matters. And the fact that both leads in both of his films are fucking amazing is also a testament to Jordan Peele as an actor or as a director.
Yeah,
and as an
eye for talent, because like Kaluuya was not known, and I've only seen him fucking kill it in every movie he's been in since Get Out. Like in Widows, he's incredible.
Yeah, he's fucking frightening.
Yeah,
in that
there's
movie.
One. There's just so many like, I could talk for an hour and a half of the cinematography in Us. It's like so beautiful and perfect, and like every single like every, you know, bullshit like every frame of painting, but like actually though.
Mm. All right, well maybe we'll do a whole Us Revisited episode, because unfortunately Austin couldn't see it early enough to join us, and it seems like our audience is really interested in the movie because we got a lot of emails. But anyway, I'm going to go ahead and wrap this up. We'll be back next week. Haven't decided which movie we're doing yet. But before we go, where can we find you guys on the internet? Let's start with Austin.
You can hit me up on Twitter, Austin_Hayden. You can hit me up on Insta, AUS_HAY. I do a philosophy podcast with my buddy Troy called Owls at Dawn that you can go ahead and check out. And yeah.
And Lux.
Oh boy. You can find me on Twitter at MLSurfboard, on the Instagram at GameBoysPod, which you can also listen to on iTunes. Jared's been a guest recently, so you can go check out the Game Boys podcast and hear me, Jared, and co-host Griffin talk about Kingdom Hearts. I also write and direct video and stuff for a wrestling show called Party World Wrestling. So go check out Party World Wrestling on Facebook and go look at my dumb videos.
And if I may just, and if I may reiterate, if you want to hear me rage about how much I hate a game, listen to the Game Boys podcast about Kingdom Hearts 3.
But if you want to hear Jared talking about how he likes the game, listen to the Game Boys podcast episode about God of War.
Exactly. All right, guys, we're going to sign off. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Peace.
Goodbye from Sydney, Australia.
And Austin, Texas.
We miss you, Ryan. Peace.